breaking news from WINY.
And we're here with Senator Christopher Murphy, who's a first-term senator, state of Connecticut, after several terms in the House of Representatives. Senator, welcome to Northeastern Connecticut. I'm really, really pleased to have you here today. I know the people of Northeastern Connecticut want to get to know you a little bit better. A congressman from another part of the state, and I think people are pleased to think that our two senators are paying a little more attention to this part of the rural part of Connecticut.
Yeah, no, it's great to be up here. What a beautiful day. We had a wonderful drive out here. We're going to spend most of the afternoon traveling throughout eastern Connecticut. And yeah, you're right. You know, I grew up in the center part of the state near Hartford. I now live in the sort of western part of the state out near Cheshire. And given the fact that I've got this amazing new job, being the junior United States Senator for the state, I'm trying to get out here to eastern Connecticut, the part of the world that doesn't know me as well as much as I can. This is my, I think, second visit in 6 months to this studio, and I'm glad to finally be here with you.
Well, Senator, I'll invite you through your aides to call into the show anytime you want. We're streaming worldwide, and we'd love to just get regular reports as to what's going on in Washington, because some of it scares us.
Would love to do that.
All right, that'd be great. Senator, first question. You served in the House of Representatives several times, and then you just moved over to the Senate. I think people would be interested. What's the difference as you see it between the House and the Senate?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of differences. I mean, obviously, the numbers are the biggest difference. When you're one of 435, you really have to, fight for relevance on the issues that you care about. When you're one of 100, it's much easier to have an impact. There's also just a little bit more collegiality and willingness to reach out across the aisle in the Senate. And I think you've seen that, this year. Just last week, we passed a bipartisan immigration reform bill that I'm sure we'll talk about. A couple weeks ago, we passed a bipartisan farm bill. And, there's a feeling that the Senate, at least in the last 6 months, is, more functional and more willing to have the two parties work with each other than the House of Representatives is. I will tell you personally, though, Paul, one of the biggest differences is that a 6-year term is very different than a 2-year term. I represented a very swing district in Northwest Connecticut, where every 2 years I was going to have to battle for my seat. And, the idea that I don't have to go right back out and run for re-election, that I don't have to go right back out and raise money for the next race, is really liberating. I've got two young kids at home, and as much as I'm going to use this time to really focus in on issues, I also like the fact that I get to spend a little bit more time with the family than I did when I was running every 2 years.
That's great. Senator, I wish you the very best in the Senate, because certainly we need solid representation right now. You mentioned the immigration bill you just passed. Please just outline for us, as you see it, the terms of the immigration bill. And I guess my part B of the question, does it have any chance of getting through the House of Representatives?
Yeah, well, I wish I knew the answer to that second question, but let me take the first one. Even though, it's a complex bill in that it rewrites essentially all of our immigration laws, it's pretty simple in that it has three parts. The first part is to get tougher on the border. It is the biggest increase in border security in the history of this nation. We are going to put $46 billion of additional money into the border. We are essentially going to militarize the border with Mexico through this bill. I will be honest with you, I think that's a little overkill. I think we could probably spend some of those billions of dollars in other places. For instance, you're going to have enough Border Patrol agents along the entirety of the Mexican border so that there is one Border Patrol agent for every 1,000 feet. I mean, you literally are going to be able to see the next agent from wherever the first one is. The second thing it does is that it creates a pathway to citizenship, a very long, arduous pathway for the 11 million people that are here without documentation. Now, you're going to have to do a lot of things in order to qualify to be a U.S. citizen. You're going to have to, have played by the rules and not violate any laws. You're going to have to pay some pretty serious fines. You're going to have to learn English. But after 13 years, you will be able to get in line and apply for citizenship. And then lastly, what it does is that it fixes the existing immigration system, because it was just broken. It took too long to try to get your loved one in here. It took too long for a company or a farm to try to get a worker here, and it fixes that system as well.
The whole system, you're looking at not only fences, but you're looking at drones, you're looking at personnel sensors, you're looking at boats, airplanes, helicopters. I wonder how the Mexicans feel about all this.
Yeah, I mean, I really do think it's overkill. It's not just personnel. The very specifically prescribed in the bill is a whole series of technological investments along the border. It is going to be very hard, if not impossible, for anybody to come across the border with illegally after this bill is passed. The goal is going to be to stop 90% of illegal migration across the border when this bill is in full effect. And I think we're going to probably hit that target pretty easily.
All right, next question, please. The Supreme Court just ordered a new standard for the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And they say that the statistics for the other were outmoded. Will they be able to pass anything through the Congress that meets the new standards, given the sectionalism in this country, Southerners versus, et cetera?
Yeah, so, I mean, the background on this is that, you know, we've had a Voting Rights Act in place since the 1960s, and one of the most important provisions of that bill was that when states that have a history of racism or counties that have a history of racism want to make changes to their voting laws that would make it harder for people to vote, they have to get those changes cleared by the Department of Justice. Because as we know, during the Jim Crow era and for a long time after that, a lot of places used the laws to try to keep blacks from voting. And the concern is that hasn't stopped today. That, for instance, in a lot of places in the South that are right now passing laws to require everybody to have a photo ID, that really is about trying to stop poor people from voting, because a lot of poor people who don't, for instance, drive, and although that's hard to think of in, you know, this part of the world, there are a lot of people who don't drive in certain urban parts of the South may not have a photo ID. And so I really think that the Supreme Court was wrong in overturning that provision of the Voting Rights Act. And your question is, are we going to be able to pass something new? I don't know. I mean, there are a lot of Republicans from the South who do want the Voting Rights Act to go away, who want to be able to pass onerous voting restriction laws. And I think it's probably a slim chance that we'll be able to pass a new Voting Rights Act in this Congress.
All right. A certain senator on the Middle East, we've been involved in Afghanistan, Iraq, and now Afghanistan, and we also have a situation with Syria. What's your position on involvement in the Middle East, especially with what's facing us in Syria?
Well, I mean, we have to be involved in the Middle East. We have obviously very important national security concerns in the Middle East, whether it's Iran trying to get a nuclear weapon, whether it's protecting our sacred ally of Israel, whether it's the fact that today we still get a lot of our energy from the Middle East. We've got to have a presence there. I have been, I think, an outlier when it comes to Syria. I do not believe that it's in our security interest to arm the rebels in Syria as President Obama wants to do. I've actually joined up with some unlikely allies like Rand Paul, who I don't agree with on a lot of things, but I agree with him on this, to try to stop the president from arming the Syrian rebels. I just worry that the Syrian rebels are fighting alongside al-Qaeda. I worry if we give them arms, those arms could fall into the hands of al-Qaeda, the very people that want to attack the United States. And then I worry in the long term that Syria is just going to turn into a very bloody long-term civil war, and that our arms are just going to be used to essentially kill a lot more people a lot faster in the long run rather than bring the conflict to a close. And so I don't want to make the same mistake we did in Iraq, the same mistake we did in mismanaging the war in Afghanistan, which was a just war, I think, at the outset. And so I'm going to continue to try to press the president to think twice about putting arms into the hands of the Syrians.
Can we gain anything in Afghanistan, even though we're kind of pulling back?
I think there's a 50-50 chance that when we pull back that we're going to be able to leave a stable country behind. I think there's also a 50% chance that the Taliban is going to come in and gain a foothold again. I wish I could tell you that the odds are different than that. What I think is that Afghanistan was a just war, that we should have gone in there and removed the Taliban, but we spent 10 years there, which is just too long, in part because we were distracted by a war that didn't make sense in Iraq. So I've for a long time thought that we should get our troops out of Afghanistan, because I'm just, you know, I think our focus should be on trying to support the government of Afghanistan, not necessarily fighting their battles. And you know, my bigger perspective on this is that Afghanistan is $2 billion a week. I mean, $2 billion a week they were putting on my kid's credit card, money that's not going to rebuild America. I just look around my state and I say, we have needs here at home, and we don't have the ability to continue to borrow money. So why are we doing it to fight a war in Afghanistan that's not making us safer? And why are we going to put billions more into Syria that might not make us safer either?
Thank you, Senator. We'll move on to Representative Issa in the House of Representatives is the chairman of a committee holding hearings about National Security Agency's surveillance program. Yeah. Are you comfortable with the answers coming out of the National Security Agency as far as domestic, overseeing us domestically with some of their weaponry, it's communications devices, yeah. Really.
Yeah, I mean, I'm comfortable with their answers in the sense that now that the program has been exposed by this guy, Edward Snowden, I think that they're telling us the truth about the program. I'm not comfortable with the fact that we have a Patriot Act on the books that I think overly compromises our privacy. I voted against extending the Patriot Act, again, you know, going against the wishes of a lot of folks in the administration, because I thought that it went too far in terms of intruding into our private lives. At the same time, I think we should find this guy Snowden, and I think we should try him in American courts, because I am equally uncomfortable with 29-year-old government contractors just deciding for themselves what information should be classified and what shouldn't. I don't think this guy is a hero. I think that it's an important conversation we're having about this program, but I just really don't like a world in which some individual can decide what secret they're going to keep and what they're not.
I sense a certain independence streak in you, Senator, as far as your ability to look at bills and come up with your own ideas. When you're a young senator, and twice you said to me, I'm kind of going against the grain.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I've gotten a little bit of attention for this bill I've sponsored with Rand Paul to stop the president from arming the Syrian rebels. And, more than, one article has said it's rare for a freshman United States senator to take on, a president of his own party so early in his time. But, as much as there are some things that I disagreed with Joe Lieberman on, the one thing I really respected about him was that he had his own mind, and he, did what he thought was right, not necessarily what he thought was in the best interest of his party. And so I definitely want to honor and follow on that part of Senator Lieberman's legacy. And so I don't agree with the president on what he's doing in Syria, and I'm not just going to stand there and pretend that I agree.
Outstanding, Senator. Thank you very much. We have a division right now among Democrats regarding the student loan rates. Of course, the Speaker of the House is kind of celebrating the fact that the Democrats are now not able to agree. Would you just kind of outline the two issues in the Democratic Party? One, because they're looking at double rates from what they used to pay.
Yeah, I mean, there's a bunch of issues here, but the basic one is that a lot of us want to set a fixed rate and just have students know that they are going to pay 3.4% on student loans for the next 10 years. And there's another part of the Democratic Party who agrees more with the Republicans that want the rate to float over time. The problem with a floating rate is that it could get up into the 6-8% range depending on market conditions. And I just don't think that students can or should be asked to afford that level of interest. The difference between a 3.4% rate and a 6.8% rate over the first 10 years of paying back your loan is on average about $4,000 to $5,000 for a student. And, I'm one of those former students that's paying back my loans. Now, I make a decent salary now, so I can afford to pay it back. But when I first got out of college, I was making $24,000 a year, and it wasn't easy for me to pay back my loans. I did it, but it wasn't easy, and I worry about a floating interest rate going up into the 6%, 7%, or 8% range.
The part about this that puzzles me, and maybe you can clarify a little bit. The government could actually make a profit if those loan rates go up.
So this is really the big. And I was going to make this point, but I didn't want to go too long on this. Yes, if you have a rate that gets up into the 6.8% or 8% range, the government makes a profit on that. When it's at 3.4, the government does not. The government basically just gets back what it sends out. But as that rate starts to creep up, the government makes money. And so the Republicans and some Democrats want the student loan program to be used for deficit reduction. Now, that sounds nice, use the student loan program for deficit reduction. But what that really means is that students are going to pay back more than they need to fund the program, and you're going to take the extra money from the students to pay down the deficit. We should pay down the deficit, but it shouldn't be students that are responsible for paying down the deficit. We should find other ways to do that.
Very good, Senator. I heard a lot about tax reform being talked about in Washington right now. We have thousands of pages of tax code, and there are loopholes more than a Swiss cheese. Do you favor closing many of those loopholes in the tax code, or is it really Mission Impossible?
Well, I think I can answer yes to both of those questions. I mean, I do favor simplifying the tax code. I think, though, it may be close to Mission Impossible because, there are some of these tax loopholes that are totally egregious, that got slipped in the middle of the night. It shouldn't be there. For instance, the ability for corporations to deduct the cost of a corporate jet. That shouldn't be tax deductible. But, the fact is that those really egregious ones don't add up to much. And, we should just admit that the ones that sound really, really bad actually don't get you a ton of savings. If you really want to simplify the tax code, then you got to talk about the ones that are a lot more popular, like the mortgage interest deduction, like the deduction for state and local taxation, like the deduction for charitable giving. And those have real public policy behind them. There's a good reason why we have those in the code, and I don't even know if I'm willing to go that far to get rid of those deductions. And so I want to simplify the tax code, but I also want to be honest with people that that's a really interesting, fun political talking point. Simplify the tax code. But when you really get into the meat and potatoes of it, there are some tax deductions in there that mean a lot to families out there. Now, what we definitely can do is simplify the corporate tax code because that thing, it really is way overly complex. And what ends up happening is that, a small little corporation, here, in northeastern Connecticut ends up paying close to the 30, plus percent rate. But then a big company like GE is paying, down near 10% because they got a whole army of accountants that find them a way to get around it. And GE's not they're playing by the rules. They're paying only what they owe, but they've got accountants to get them around paying the tax in a way that a lot of smaller or mid-sized companies don't.
There have been charges that some of the large corporations, Microsoft, et cetera, hide money overseas in Ireland, for instance, where only 4% of their workers are, but 65% of the assets are held. Can that be stopped?
Absolutely, it can be stopped. But I don't know. I get a little squeamish when I hear, some of my colleagues, calling these companies tax cheats.
They're playing by the rules.
They're playing by the rules. And, who am I to tell, a corporate accountant that if they can get around paying U.S. taxes under the current rules that, that they should voluntarily decide to pay more? Now, maybe sometimes they truly are, violating the rules, but we should change the rules. And I think a lot of times, politicians blame people. That's why I don't blame millionaires for paying low tax rates. It's not their fault. They're paying the tax rate that we ask them to pay, which sometimes is as low as 10% or 12%. I just think we should change the rules.
Change the rules. This tax reform.
I say that like it's easy. I say that like changing the rules is easy, but it's not. It's not so easy.
You're trying to squeeze anything through Congress right now. It's trying to squeeze a camel through the eye of a needle. That's another matter. What challenges do you see in putting the Affordable Health Care bill into the final implementation?
Well, we got a couple challenges. One is that as we bring 30 million people onto the rolls of the insured. We got to make sure we got enough doctors to take care of them. And, you know, the fact is that in the last 10 to 20 years, you know, a lot of doctors have been going into the specialties, not into primary care, because primary care doesn't pay that well these days. I mean, listen, it sounds, you know, $80,000, $100,000 sounds like a lot of money, but when you have $200,000 of student loans to pay back, it's not. And so they're going into, you know, dermatology and orthopedics, places where they can make more money. So the first big challenge is how do you get more people in primary care? And the second challenge is there is an inevitability when you bring a whole bunch of people from uninsured to insured that rates are going to go up temporarily for healthier, younger people, because you're going to bring a whole bunch of people on to the rolls of the insured that are sicker. Now, over time, rates will smooth out because those people will get access to preventative health care and they won't be as sick. But that's not for another 5 or 10 years. And so, you know, I just think we have to be honest with people that for especially the young well, rates in the short term are going to be a little bit higher. Now, they're going to get access to these subsidies that will help them pay for health care. But for some people, rates will go up. For other people, rates will go down. But there will be a little bit of dislocation at the beginning of this bill when it really goes into effect early next year.
The another 2,000-page bill, are there parts of the bill that you're finding out about that are you know, disturbing?
Well, you know, I mean, I never, you know, bought this soundbite that a lot of opponents of the bill use that said nobody in Congress read the bill. I mean, you know, it's our job to read bills. And, you know, I was on the committee that wrote the health care bill, so I knew it backwards and forwards. And if there were a handful of members of Congress that didn't read the bill, shame on them. That's your job. You're supposed to work, you know, a full day. And as part of that day, you should be able to read the legislation you vote on. So, but, you know, I think that we should be open to changing the bill as it goes into effect. I mean, you know, we, as on any piece of legislation, you make an educated judgment as to what you think is going to work. But then you have to put it into place. And if it doesn't work as intended, you have to be, you know, willing to go back and change it. And so we should be willing to change the healthcare bill if it doesn't work as intended.
As with other bills, a work in progress?
Well, I think I don't know if a work in progress is the right word, but you just have to be amenable to making changes. We made changes to Medicare after it was put into place. We made changes to Social Security after it was put in place. And we're likely going to have to make changes to the health care bill, and we'll just have to be open to that.
There are pipeline issues right now. What is your position on development of an infrastructure for alternative energy sources? You know, there are so many possibilities. In that question, you know, what do you think the best possibility is? And then what should we do about alternative energy sources?
Well, here's, I guess, how I think about this. I mean, I just think the government should get out of the business of picking and choosing winners and losers when it comes to renewable energy. I don't get as crazed about this Solyndra thing as other people do, because anytime you're investing in new technologies, you're going to pick a couple lemons. And you know what? Venture capital firms, you know, invest in companies that go belly up too, just like the government. But I think that what we should be doing is just setting a whole new market. So I like the idea, for instance, of the government setting a condition that 25% of all energy has to be from renewable sources, or that we have to decrease the amount of pollution coming from carbon by X amount, and then let the market decide who wins and who loses. Let Northeast Utilities, you know, decide whether they're going to meet that goal by investing in conservation or investing in nuclear or investing in fuel cells or solar. I just think that we should let the market decide rather than the government deciding. But I think the government should set a really aggressive goal, you know, either a goal of how much reduction in carbon emissions we want, or how much of the electricity we use, for instance, comes from renewable sources.
Do you feel that nuclear is an option as far as renewable is concerned?
Absolutely. Now, we got to obviously answer, you know, the big question, which is where do you put all of the waste? I'm a supporter of, you know, the Yucca Mountain site in Nevada, but, you know, I understand that there's some political difficulties with that these days. But I think that, you know, if we can solve that problem of disposal, nuclear has a future, at least in the, you know, next 20 to 30 years. I'll tell you, though, people should, in Time magazine this week, there's a great short article on this new solar thermal plant going into the Mojave Desert in California. It's amazing. This thing is thousands of mirrors that essentially heat water in a big tower that will provide heat, provide electricity to 160,000 homes in California just through one solar plant. And that is the future. I mean, we really can start to build big solar power plants now we can't do it in Connecticut. So the future for Connecticut is more transmission lines that can get some of this renewable energy from hydro dams in Canada, from solar and wind power plants out in the Midwest and the West.
Actually, we have one going through. As it's been planned, I had someone on the show this last week. Last question, because your aide is standing there. I know you've got someplace to go.
Luckily, I have a couple good friends here in town who are throwing me a party that I'm going to go to now.
That'd be great. But in the House, you had a limited amount of time, and you could speak. In the Senate, if you wish to, you can stand up and speak to an issue, as the woman in Texas did in her Senate. Actually, almost nobody filibusters anymore. It's called, you basically just have to threaten it and things die. You can only overturn it with 60% of the vote. Do you favor that plan and that system?
No, I think it's absolutely nuts that you have to have 60 votes to pass anything in the United States Senate today. It used to be 50 years ago, you know, back when we thought of the filibuster and Mr. Smith goes to Washington terms, that it was only used once a year, once every couple of years. Now, the Republicans who are in the minority use the filibuster on every single piece of legislation and every single amendment so that nothing passes with 50 votes. Everything has to pass with 60 votes. And it just doesn't make any sense. We should move to a 50-vote threshold. And to me, we got a system of government that's hard enough to pass something. You got to get two houses of Congress to support it, and then you got to get the president to sign it. In most democratic systems across the globe, they just have a parliamentary system in which the parliament has to agree to something. Maybe a president has to sign it, and that's it. So I would go to 50 votes if it was up to me.
I guess I'm really pleased that you came here today.
Yeah.
It's hard for us who don't know the process to look at it with a whole lot of optimism, as because you've just described something very difficult to do. Do you look at the future with optimism?
Of course I do. I don't think you can do this job if you aren't optimistic about the future. And you know, I approach this job every day knowing, you know, the frustration that's there. But then you get, you know, moments like we did this week when we passed a big bipartisan immigration bill that had conservative Republicans and liberal Democrats coming together around a compromise solution, and you sort of see, you know, the possibility of this place. And, you know, I could have chosen a lot of different, you know, ways to spend my life. And it's tough being away half the week from my two little boys, a 4-year-old and a 1-year-old. But I believe in this country. I believe in this state that, you know, I grew up in, that my parents grew up in, and I want to make it better. And I know there are a lot of days that I go to the Senate and I leave the Senate and I think, oh, boy, you know, what did I really accomplish today? I mean, I felt like I banged my head up against the wall. But occasionally you do some good things. And, you know, that's why I'm there, because I still believe in this country. And I still believe, even as broken as it seems in a lot of days, on this government.
Senator, I hope that you become a regular participant and visitor to Northeastern Connecticut. It's been wonderful for the people to get to know you today a little bit. You're welcome to come in any time, of course, and we'll clear a calendar for you. And,
well, I'll take your offer to call in. I'll try to do
you
that.
You can feel free to call in at any time.
Yeah, I will.
And we're streamed worldwide, so you know, you can get the word out and you know, talk to your constituents, let them know how you stand.
Sounds good.
All right. Thank you much.